From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley. And this morning, our first guest is Gahea Pacheco. She is the co-executive director of the Women's Earth Alliance, a nonprofit with a mission of supporting and empowering women's leadership to protect the environment and the climate crisis and ensure a just and thriving world.
Then Trish Kenlon joins the show in the second half. Trish is the founder of Sustainable Career Pathways, a job search coaching consultancy that has helped thousands of professionals transition into climate and sustainability work. She also serves as president of the Utah Sustainable Business Network. That's in the second part of the show. Environmental awareness and education. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
And welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us now is Gahea Pacheco. And Gahea is with the Women's Earth Alliance, the co-executive director. Welcome, Gahea.
Aloha. Aloha mai. Aloha aina kako. Thank you so much for having me.
Of course, we are so glad to welcome you to This Green Earth. And I want to first start out with a little bit about you, your background, but also maybe overview kind of the 411 on the Women's Earth Alliance.
Absolutely. So Women's Earth Alliance, WEA for short, started as a circle of about 30 women from 26 countries who gathered in Mexico City in 2006. Now, these were women who were leading environmental and social justice movements in their communities. So they were indigenous land defenders, clean energy advocates, water protectors, regenerative farmers. You know, these were people who had already been doing the work, but they kept running into the same barriers. They kept experiencing a lack of access to funding and resources, a lack of recognition and access to decision-making spaces, and an overall feeling of isolation. So many of them felt like they were doing this incredibly hard work alone and without networks of support. So they did what, you know, women leaders have always done. They built the support system that they needed, and that circle and that support system became Women's Earth Alliance. So today we're a global organization working to protect our environment and the climate crisis and ensure a just and thriving world by strengthening women's leadership. So for almost two decades now, WEA has been a leader in the gender and climate space, working hand in hand with grassroots women leaders and locally led organizations. And our programs are collaborative by design, ensuring that the solutions we're putting forward are built by the people who know their communities the best. So together we co-design programs that offer training and mentorship to build women's leadership and technical skills and long-term strategy, funding and resources to get women-led solutions off the ground and to help them grow, and a global alliance that connects women leaders across regions to share strategies and, you know, build powerful movements. So our programs focus on regenerative agriculture and food systems, conservation and ecosystem restoration, sustainable livelihoods, clean energy access and advocacy, health and well-being, and indigenous knowledge. And since that first gathering, WEA has partnered with more than 53,000 women leaders in 31 countries. And together we've reached over 24 million people with clean water and sustainable food and renewable energy and economic opportunities. You know, really at its heart, WEA is an invitation to reimagine what climate action can look like when it's rooted in care, in community, and in collective power, where women aren't an afterthought in climate solutions. They're part of the very blueprint of them.
Right. We often find that women tend to be the ones that will learn and absorb and then go to the community and share that with the community and not walk away with that knowledge to serve themselves, but to serve others.
Absolutely. We call that the ripple effect. When you train women, you give them the access, you support them to really enliven the solutions they're already making possible in their communities. We see a larger spread of impact. We see, you know, ecosystems restoring. We see sometimes even like peace becoming more possible. We see children getting more education. We see all of these things happening. And it starts with just supporting and resourcing women.
Well, I think that's amazing. And can you talk about some of the groundwork that has been laid? What are some of the things that you're seeing that this is really working?
Yeah. So one of the things I love about this work is that the impact is both immediate and long-term. So it's not just about, you know, solving a problem today, but about building systems, building the systems that will make change last for generations. So like I had said about that ripple effect, you know, entire families and communities have gained access to clean water and sustainable food systems, renewable energy. And what's powerful about this is that women have the tools and resources they need so that that transformation keeps going. You know, just last year, we trained 6,812, I believe, women and girls across 13 countries. They're addressing climate threats head on, securing land rights, creating economic opportunities, designing strategies to protect communities from environmental harm. And because of their leadership, in 2024 alone, you know, 665,000-ish people were reached with these life-saving environmental solutions. More than 116,000 trees were grown, protecting forests, sequestering carbon, restoring vital landscapes. Nearly 1,000 hectares of land was restored and protected, more than twice the size of Central Park in New York. 1,500 women-led climate groups were funded. And what's just as important as these numbers is what they mean for people's lives. So in Kenya, WIA-trained eco-entrepreneurs are leading reforestation efforts and launching tree nurseries that are not only bringing back critical water sources, but also creating new sources of income for families. Across South Asia, our Women in Rivers Accelerator, which is done in partnership with International Rivers, is training river defenders who are pushing back against destructive hydropower projects and ensuring their communities have a voice in water governance. So that's just some of the impact we've seen just in the last year.
I'm reading about a program you're involved in Nigeria called the Women's Clean Cook Stoves Training Program. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about what that is?
Yeah, so we have partnered with Wise Nigeria, who the founder of Wise Nigeria, Olanike Olukboji, is one of WIA's founding mothers. So she was at that initial circle in 2006, and she's gone through also a few WIA trainings, and she launched a grassroots NGO called WISE. And since, you know, 2008, we've been partnering with her in various capacities. And this WISE Clean Cook Stoves program recognizes that, I believe, let me see. So in Nigeria, I think the smoke from dirty, you know, traditional wood burning cook stoves is still the third highest killer of women and girls. Behind malaria and HIV/AIDS. And not only that, but it also contributes to deforestation. When women have to gather firewood, they are having to walk longer and longer distances from home, which increases the threat of violence against them. And so what the program has done is trained women leaders in communities to become clean cookstove entrepreneurs. We've held business kind of development trainings, leadership trainings. We've given them access to a marketplace for clean cook stoves where they've been able to select the clean cook stoves that they want to sell because they work the best in their community. And they've begun selling them. And I mean, it has been, you know, in a year, one of the women had sold more than 1,000 clean cook stoves to families. And that's not just the women who are benefiting in those families. It's those entire families that are no longer breathing dirty air in their homes. And the women entrepreneurs are now having a sustainable income. So they've been quite supported by their communities.
And an important point, Kahea, is that, again, there's an environmental impact associated with that, a benefit associated with cleaner cook stoves that reduce the amount of wood that is, I'm sure, in some areas of Nigeria, precious. And now it's not going to as a fuel. So it benefits, you know, humans and the environment at the same time.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point. That's pretty much everything that WEA does has that sort of intersectional impact. We address issues holistically. So we're not just addressing, you know, an environmental impact. We're looking at what causes the environmental impact, what sustains the environmental impact. How can we shift that in a positive way that is also something that can be long-term? And all of that is just part of that intersectional and holistic model.
Yeah, and you have a term, intersectional environmentalism, on your website, and you kind of gave us the definition there, but maybe diving a little deeper in how your organization is helping to bring people to the forefront of the conversation around the effects of a changing climate, and not separating that and just thinking about the natural world and the environment, but also understanding how much of a part of it the humans play. And then when you save the environment, you're also giving safety measures for humans.
Yeah, this is a great point, and I hope I can do it the importance of it justice with my answer. So yes, intersectional environmentalism is a framework that recognizes that environmental crises don't affect all communities equally, and that our responses have to be just as interconnected as the challenges we face. So to give credit where it's absolutely due, this builds on the concept of intersectionality introduced by Professor Kimberly Crenshaw, which describes how systems of power like racism, sexism, economic injustice overlap to shape people's lived experiences. So when we talk about intersectional environmentalism, we're saying you can't actually solve the climate crisis without also addressing gender inequity, racial injustice, and economic inequality. And Lea Thomas really helped to bring this framing into today's climate discourse, and her work has really helped open up this conversation for more people and for generations. Indigenous women, Black women, and frontline women around the world have led with the understanding that our struggles and our solutions are deeply connected, because climate change wasn't caused and doesn't act in isolation. It's a threat multiplier. It takes existing cracks and widens them, making things like poverty and food insecurity, displacement, health disparities, making them worse. Women and children around the world are 14 times more likely than men to die in climate-related disasters. Hmm. About 80% of people displaced by climate change are women. And we also see that when women's leadership is centered, everything shifts. So countries with more women in government are more likely to ratify environmental treaties and adopt stronger climate policies. Conservation efforts are more successful when Indigenous women are leading stewardship work. So intersectional environmentalism isn't just a way of understanding the problem. It's a roadmap for building real and lasting solutions. And that's why at WEA, as I was saying, our work is holistic. We don't separate the environment from the economy or climate from community. We support women leading at the intersection of environmental justice, economic justice, and social justice. So they're restoring ecosystems and building climate resilience. They're growing women-led green businesses that support livelihoods and heal the earth. And they're improving health, safety, and gender equity so women and girls can thrive and lead all at the same time. And I think part of bringing people, as you were saying, to the forefront of conversations about the impacts of climate change, like specifically bringing the people, it's about flipping kind of the whole climate change narrative. For too long, you know, the dominant climate conversation has cast women, especially Indigenous women and women of color, as victims or as passive recipients of aid. And it's done the same for communities in general, prioritizing voices of the powerful, who are often deeply implicated in the activities that are causing climate change, and ignoring the voices of the most impacted. Mm. And that framing is incomplete and, quite frankly, I think dangerous. It erases leadership that's already in motion, and it reinforces the systems that got us into this crisis in the first place. So we're trying to change that lens. We invest in those grassroots women leaders and recognize them as what they are, policy shapers, movement builders, caretakers, innovators, and we support them to shape public narratives, influence policy, testify in government hearings, lead advocacy that, you know, reflects the lived experience of their communities.
We are speaking now with Kaheya Pacheco here on This Green Earth. And Kaheya is part of the Women's Earth Alliance and the co-executive director. Now, when you got involved with this organization, Kaheya, how long have you been with them? And what strides have you seen, or what do you see as some of the future things that you are really hoping to tackle with this organization?
This is a great question. I guess a good place to start here is at the beginning. So I was raised and now raise my family on Hawaii Island, where people and place are, you know, just deeply connected. And I think living somewhere so rural and so isolated, everything we do is connected to the land. And we're able to see firsthand that the land, if it's not cared for, is not infinite. And we're seeing this happen more and more, you know, food insecurity, weather pattern shifting, wildfires getting more intense. And scientists estimate that 40% of Hawaii's current coastline will be underwater by 2050, which means that communities are going to be displaced, ecosystems destroyed, low-lying areas, which is where so much of our food production happens, are going to be gone. And for a long time, I thought the most direct path to addressing these issues and really making a difference was through law. So I went to law school to focus on Indigenous rights and environmental justice. But what I found over and over was that while the law is an incredibly important tool, it's not always the most powerful one. The most transformative solutions I saw weren't coming from courtrooms. They were coming from communities, especially women whose work, you know, is rooted in care and relationship and deep understanding of land and culture. And that's what brought me to Women's Earth Alliance almost 15 years ago now. I started out as an intern. And I like to joke around that I'm kind of just the intern they could never get rid of. Mm-hmm. And so they finally were like, well, you want to be a co-executive director? which is, you know, just, it's not true, but it's just an amusing way of thinking of it. So I am one of the co-executive directors now, and I help lead our strategy and programs alongside my fellow co-directors, Melinda Kramer and Amira Diamond, who are also the co-founders. My role is about making sure the grassroots are part of the conversation and making sure everything we do reflects the priorities and brilliance and lived experience of the women we partner with. And in that capacity, I also serve as a kind of creative director, helping shape how our values come through in our storytelling and our identity and the way we invite people into this work. And then, you know, also focusing on partnerships and bringing in the resources this work needs to grow so that it's not just about responding to crises in the here and now, but about creating long-term systemic change. And I think in the past, you know, 15 years I've been with the organization, we've seen a real like shift in the mainstream conversation, where when we started, no one was really talking about women and climate. No one wanted to listen to women's voices and their experience and their expertise. No one was prioritizing grassroots women leaders and thinking of the strategies that they were bringing forward, the solutions they were bringing forward. No one was thinking of them as this, along the same lines as like the very institutionalized, pedigreed kind of solutions coming out of nation states and research institutes and huge, big green NGOs. And we've definitely seen that change. In the last, you know, 5 to 7 years alone, we've seen more and more organizations starting to put a lens, like a very specific, starting to put very specific attention on these points of intersection where gender and climate meet, or where gender and race and climate meet, or where economics and climate meet. And I think the more that happens, which is what I'm really excited about seeing in the years to come, the more we're going to actually get to the bottom of the issue and find solutions that work for the long term.
Well, here in the U.S. and Canada, I'm reading through some of the initiatives that you've launched here in this area of the country. Specifically, in 2016, we launched the Violence on the Land, Violence on Our Bodies initiative. Talk a little bit about that.
That came out of my experience in law school and working on, you know, Indigenous rights and federal Indian law and seeing the increase. Not actually, I don't think it was an increase. I think it was just the uncovering of violence against Indigenous women. And then as I transitioned into my work here at WEA, between 2008 and 2012, that was, there was a huge like extractive industry oil boom, typically around like the back in the area and even in like Denita, so Navajo territories. And we were starting to hear from community members that there was an increase in violence, that things were happening and nobody was talking about it. And so we reached out to a bunch of our partners. And one of the partners we reached out to is Native Youth Sexual Health Network, which is an organization by and for Indigenous youth that works across sexual and reproductive health rights and justice. They kind of confirmed like, yes, this is happening and there's no documentation of it. And people don't know what to do. Like, what are the solutions? What are the things that communities can bring forward to really address this? And so we embarked on this initiative and we spent a year going into communities across Canada and across the US, talking to community members about what was going on. And it was true, you know, in these communities that we're seeing an influx, the population growth was extreme because of the extractive industry that had been growing in their communities. You were seeing populations of non-tribal community members coming in and not having the increased policing support, not having communications and telecommunications support, not having the infrastructure in communities to support that huge of a boom. Sometimes it was 300% increase in population. And these a lot of times were people who were going to be having a lot of money because of the industry they were in, but the communities they were in didn't have like a huge nightlife. There wasn't a lot to do with that. And so I think it created some boredom too. And already Indigenous women, they kind of fall through a jurisdictional loophole when they are, you know, when they experience sexual violence between states and tribes and federal government, there is a lot of red tape and no one knows who has jurisdiction over which crimes. Sometimes it's an unfunded mandate for states to prosecute crimes. And so really they could experience violence and there would be no recourse. Mm-hmm. And so when we were doing kind of this research and gathering these testimonies, we approached it as, you know, okay, what are the legal protections that we can advocate for Indigenous communities living in extractive zones, which are also known as sacrifice zones. And what we kept hearing from community members was that wasn't what they wanted. They wanted community driven. They wanted resources that could be nation specific. And so eventually what this work became was a research report and a toolkit. And so the research report is still freely available for download at landbodydefense.org for anybody to use. And it has the testimonies and a bunch of research. And then there's a toolkit that was put together by Native Youth Sexual Health Network in collaboration with a lot of the community members. There's recipes for medicines, traditional medicines that can be made nation specific. So if people are going on a walk to protect water, there's some medicines to support their health while on the walk. There's healing remedies. There are workshops to talk to your community about environmental violence, which is not a new term, but it's not yet a widely known term.
Right.
And then it has an environmental violence assessment that communities can use to figure out like what exactly is happening, what are the impacts they're feeling, and to really start that documentation process.
Also, what's interesting, the Women's Earth Alliance is also involved in marine ocean conservation and sustainable fishing, something that, again, we don't think of women very much involved in fishing and diving, et cetera, but women do a lot of work in and on the ocean.
Absolutely. So we have a lot of our ocean-focused work is happening either in Indonesia or in Mexico. Right now, one of our partners in Mexico, Sirenas de México, it's a collective of three different organizations that work specifically with women in marine ecosystems.
Right.
And it is looking at supporting women divers, training and supporting women divers to do the marine assessments of their coastlines and protecting the various coastlines, and also getting recognition, because like you said, not a lot of women divers, it's still a very, both in the science and then in the actual like diving, it's still a very male heavily dominated field. And so making sure that the women have support, the network, which is, you know, at the core of WEA, to continue doing their work, to feel like they can grow their work and that their work is actually making a difference. So a lot of really exciting things. In Indonesia, our leaders are doing a bunch of coral restoration, which is really exciting. And, you know, if you travel to Indonesia, you can go and help them do their coral restoration. So it's very cool things. And it is, I will say, like, we often don't think of ocean conservation when we're thinking of climate, which, you know, I think is a big blind spot we have, considering that the ocean is a huge carbon sink. We tend to think of carbon sinks as, you know, just our forests, which are like, they're absolutely critical, but so is the ocean.
We talk a lot about ocean health here this green earth and how important it is. And I love the lens that you talked about, focusing on the human aspect first, the people first, and kind of understanding if we help with the environment, that will in turn make a huge difference in all of these issues that are being cited, and how working together is the only way to do that. And I love that it's women focused. I like to talk a lot about hope here. Climate subjects can get very heavy. There's a lot going on in the world today. But with a message of hope, Kaheya, where do you see us going in the future? And what kind of hope have you seen from all of these programs and these women that I'm sure are rising to the challenge?
I really appreciate this question, because this is, so one of WEA's core values is joy. And that's a very intentional choice. You know, there has not been a single training we have done around the world in 20 years that song hasn't broken out. Like, there's so much singing and laughter in these trainings that we do, that, you know, these are frontline climate defenders, and they still bring so much joy, because I think, and it's a lesson that I learn and I continue to relearn from them every day of this work, is that they are doing this work from this immense place of love and hope and appreciation. They're doing it for love of the land and for love of their communities and for love and like hope for future generations. They are loving people who don't even exist yet enough to really work so hard to change the systems that we're in. And that kind of resilience in the face of all that's being thrown at them, really, they don't stop. And a part of me, the major part of me, the primary part of me, is like, if they can maintain hope on the front lines, I can maintain hope to continue giving them whatever they need. Mm-hmm. Like, they are doing this and they continue to do it because they are seeing results. And all we need to do is connect the dots and grow the impact they are already making possible. If we can do that, if we can do our job well, then those future generations that they're continuing to do this work for are going to be fine, because we're changing things. Right now, we just need more people to come alongside us and more people to come alongside these women leaders. There will always be mountains to climb, but I think if we just stand alongside these women leaders, we will be able to scale those mountains. They've never stopped. They've been doing this for generation upon generation. That kind of stamina, that's really worth something. And so that's the hope I bring in. And we try and do that in our work. You know, every month on social media, we gather and we do a roundup of like good news or uplifting news for and we share that out. Anything that's climate related that has come across our desks, because we really don't want people to get stuck in this hole of climate doomism, because that becomes resignation. And the truth is that kind of eco fatigue and climate doomism and that resignation, that's a privilege for a lot of people. Some, like a lot of the communities we work with, they can't afford to stop hoping. They can't afford to stop working. And I think that once we realize that the global is local, that we're all so connected, we'll realize that none of us can really afford to stop hoping and to stop working.
I love that perspective that it is all local and globally, wherever we are on the planet, we are all as one working toward these goals. And that's such a great way to put it. Kahea Pacheco, the Women's Earth Alliance co-executive director. We are so pleased to have you on this Green Earth, and we appreciate everything that the Women's Earth Alliance is doing. If people want to learn more about your programs, where can they go?
Absolutely. If you want to learn more about Women's Earth Alliance and the work we're doing, the best place to start is our website, womensearthalliance.org. Mm-hmm. There you'll find stories from WEA leaders, updates on our programs, ways to take action. You can also find us on social media, on Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, and we're sharing the latest on our initiatives, highlights from women leaders at the heart of this work, and providing opportunities to get involved.
Well, I certainly hope that we can speak with you again, because I'm sure there is plenty more to talk about that you are doing there at the Women's Earth Alliance. Thank you so much, Kahea.
Yeah. Thanks, Kahea.
Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about our relationships with and impacts upon the environment. Let's move on to our second guest.
Please.
Trish Kenlon joins us, and Trish is the founder of Sustainable Career Pathways. It's a popular job search coaching consultancy that has helped thousands of professionals transition into climate and sustainability work. She also serves as president of the Utah Sustainable Business Network. Trish, thank you so much for joining Claire and me on This Green Earth.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with a little bit more about your background. How did you get involved in the sustainability profession?
Yeah, so my early career was in operations and consulting roles at places like Bank of America and IBM. And I loved consulting and change management, but I hit a point where I wanted to start driving more of the strategy behind the work and transition to corporate sustainability. My husband was looking to make a change as well, so we went to NYU to get our MBAs together. Those were the earlier days of impact and sustainability in higher ed. And
right. And
at the time, the specialization that was available at Stern was more focused on social entrepreneurship. So I had to find a way to make this pivot into sustainability without the benefit of a formal track. And so that meant doing a lot of independent research, learning, and networking. And because of that hard work, I was part of the second cohort of the Environmental Defense Fund Climate Corps Fellowship.
Hmm.
And yeah, the hiring
yeah.
manager, they got my resume from three different people. So they had to at least give me an interview, right?
Right.
Yeah. So for your listeners who may not be familiar with it, the EDF Climate Corps program trains graduate students in decarbonization and other sustainability strategies. They pair them with organizations that have projects they want to move forward, and then they provide them with project support throughout the summer. So if you're a graduate student, it's a fantastic, fantastic program. So my fellowship experience was just amazing. Mm-hmm. It gave me some great experience, and I was able to use that experience to get a job at Ann Taylor after graduation as their first official sustainability hire.
Ann Taylor, that's
the clothing.
Yeah. Clothing, okay.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's the women's clothing company that's behind Ann Taylor and Loft. And it's just, yeah, that's a great.
Can I pause you there? Because I think that's interesting. And what year was that they started to think, oh, we're really needing to be a little bit better about our practices here?
Yeah, that was around 2010.
Okay.
Wow.
All
yeah.
right.
Okay.
Yeah, so they've been thinking about it for a while now, which is pretty great.
And then you founded this company or business, Sustainable Career Pathways.
Yeah.
When did that happen? And what's it about?
Yeah, so Ann Taylor was a complete and total dream job. I loved every minute of it. But, you know, after a few years, I had my daughter. And we lived in New Jersey. I had a very long commute into New York. Traffic in Park City is nothing compared to New Jersey.
But at times, it's much slower.
Yeah, that's true.
For a reason.
Yes, that is true. and they basically, they had a zero remote work policy. You know, this was before COVID.
Sure.
And
schlepping into the city every day.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so I basically had to decide between my dream job and only seeing my daughter on weekends. And I chose my daughter, and I would do it again in a heartbeat.
Yes.
No contest. So while I was focusing on being a mom, sustainability kept growing in popularity and people kept reaching out to me or sending their friends to me in hopes that I could help them figure out how to make their own transitions. So I started documenting the resources I was sharing and formalizing the approach I used for helping people, and so a business was born.
Wow, okay. Yeah, give us some examples of some success stories. People have used sustainable pathways.
Yeah, so I work with clients one-on-one and really just helping them transform from, you know, this moment where you're saying, you know, I have this feeling where I know I want to use my career to make an impact in something that I care about, but maybe they're not super clear on the details of what they care about or right. what they can bring to the table or things like that. So I really help people get clear about, you know, okay, do you care about waste or do you care about carbon, or do you, you know, what is it that's important to you?
Right. And you mentioned Ann Taylor. Yeah, the clothing industry can have a big environmental impact, ecological impact on the land, on the water, air, etc. So there's a lot of efforts there to become more sustainable. What about some other industries? Are there sustainability opportunities in, let's say, the agricultural industry or the marine industry or the oil industry or so? I mean, where is sustainability going today
days? Believe it or not, I have had clients that work in the oil and gas industry.
Right.
there actually are sustainability jobs in there as well. I mean, that's kind of why it is both fascinating and inspiring, but also challenging,
yes.
because there are jobs to work that where you could work in sustainability in literally any industry in the world. Any industry obviously has opportunities to decarbonize, right?
Yes.
We all use energy, we all use materials, there's opportunities everywhere. However, which sustainability issue you're going to work on the most is going to depend on what's material for your industry. So, you know, you mentioned the fashion industry, right? In
right.
fashion, obviously, you know, materials, waste, circular economy is huge for the fashion industry right now. You know, whereas maybe in, say, you know, an accounting firm, maybe you're looking at more your employee travel and your scope 3 and things like that. So there's opportunities everywhere. It's just a question of, you know, really thinking through, you know, what do you care about and what do you know about and what do you want to do day to day?
And there is a lot of growth in B Corps.
Yeah.
And people are more likely to step into a business with a conscious mind now, I think, because we have to look through it as a lens of our impact.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that consumers are showing that they are looking through your business with a lens of impact and sustainability. Are you finding with this next generation that there's a lot of interest in businesses and B Corps and how they are looking to be effective in this changing of our environment in the world?
Yeah, absolutely. Incorporating a element of impact into your career is really, really important to Gen Z. It is starting to be a differentiator for employers that are interested in attracting Gen Z talent. You know, you mentioned B Corp. B Corp is in a really interesting moment right now as they're completely overhauling their scoring methodology and their certification methodology. So it's going to be really exciting to see what comes of all that. And actually, we have a B Corp here in Utah. It's a shout out to CE Solar. They've been B Corp certified for quite a while now.
And Cotopaxi is also a B Corp.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Thank you.
Spend a minute explaining what a B Corp is.
So B Corp is, I believe the title of their organization is B Labs, right? That's B Lab. That's an organization that runs a certification program.
Okay.
It follows a lot of the same dimensions as our Park City, Summit County Green Business Program certification, where there are a number of different sustainability dimensions that a company can work towards to help improve their practices, and then you get a certain number of points, and once you're finished, you're certified, and you can tell your customers and your business partners that you're doing good things.
Okay, so focused on industry, private businesses, etc. How about municipalities? Do you help people pursue work and sustainability with cities or counties or other governmental organizations?
Absolutely. I mean, again, going back to the theme of sustainability is everywhere if you look for it, right? Yeah. Even here in Park City, our Park City Municipal Corporation, we have a fantastic sustainability team.
Yes.
They're doing absolutely amazing things. And, you know, they're doing things like working on that big renewable energy project that's going to impact both our community and the communities around us and other organizations. And they're working on our own sustainability as a city, but also helping our residents and our businesses be more sustainable. So there's lots of fantastic opportunities.
Yeah, and just to add to that, you know, water conservation programs are part of a sustainability package. Like you mentioned, energy, whether it's electricity or use of natural gas, use of fuel, gas and diesel, that falls under the rubric of sustainability. Food waste, absolutely. Solid waste.
Yeah, shout out to the Residential Food Waste Collection Program.
The sustainability umbrella is very large.
Yeah.
And so you can look at that and see lots of opportunities to be more efficient with the energy we consume, the natural resources we consume, and the waste that we generate.
Yeah.
So that's what the sustainability officer might be tasked with.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, maybe we can take a step back and talk just a little bit about like what a sustainability job is, right? And I think what we're dancing around is that it's an incredibly tricky question to answer because different people draw the boundaries of sustainability in different ways. So when I talk about sustainability jobs, I generally mean roles that do one or more of the following, right? So first, and I think this is the one that comes to mind first for most people, and it's what we've been talking about, right, is improving an organization's environmental impact. So those are the roles that reduce negative impacts like carbon emissions, energy or water use, and raw material consumption, or they're actively improving environmental outcomes through conservation, restoration, and biodiversity initiatives.
Mm-hmm.
But there, you know, there's also improving an organization's social impact, so making people's lives better. One of my absolute favorite companies is a company called Tony's Chocolonely.
Yes.
And if you haven't heard their story, it's amazing. Go check it out. You know, but their whole company is founded on trying to reduce forced labor and child labor in the cocoa supply chain. So very cool company. And you know,
very challenging too.
Yeah,
no doubt.
It is very, very hard, but I mean, you have to give them points for how hard they're working to solve that. They're also trying to solve it systemically too, right? It's not like they're just, you know, taking their secrets of eliminating these bad things in the supply chain and keeping them to themselves. They're trying really hard to help impact the entire cocoa supply chain for everyone. So it's pretty inspiring. Another one is improving resilience. So, you know, helping our community to be more resistant to the impacts of climate change, or helping, you know, develop plans for facilities that might be at a high risk of loss from a climate event, things like that. And certainly last but not least is the other organizations that enable others to make those improvements. So there's lots of consultants out there, you know, you mentioned government agencies, financial organizations and nonprofits that all support this work. So there's lots of different flavors to sustainability work, but it doesn't fit very neatly into a box.
So Trish, if I were to come to you, you're talking about this sharing of knowledge, which I love, that if you are going forward and you're kind of a trailblazer in this and you're making sure that people are taken care of, which we just talked about with the Women's Earth Alliance, is making it people forward, and then you find out that you're also saving the planet in the long run. So when I would come to you, what is some of the things that you would share with me to help me move forward in a career of sustainability?
Yeah, well, so I think it really depends on kind of where you are in your journey in terms of what you're looking for and what you're hoping to do. You know, I think a lot of people don't realize that they can start working towards a career in sustainability right where they are, right where they're at right now. For example, Project Drawdown's job function action guides are incredible. They're for employees who work in one of 12 common corporate functions like HR or procurement. And each guide describes how someone in your role can make a climate impact. It lists the tangible actions that you can take, and it provides key resources to help you get started. So you don't even need a new job. you, you can get started today. If you're more interested in policy, Climate Voices Climate Action at Work Guide can help you learn how to influence the decision makers at your company to be better advocates for effective climate policy. So really great stuff there. But if you're ready to work in sustainability full-time, there are a lot of resources available for learning about the different career options out there. So my two favorite are the Sustainability Defined podcast and the Voice Academy Climate Careers podcast. So those are great. So absolutely step one, the thing I would share with you is just kind of going over the landscape of the careers that are out there and helping you to kind of think through which ones are a good fit for you. Yeah, so there's more. But
okay, but we only have a few minutes left. I want to learn more about the Utah Sustainable Business Coalition. You're president of that. What is that coalition about?
Yeah,
who's
so
involved?
Yeah, thanks so much for asking. So the Utah Sustainable Business Network is a network of over 500 businesses, sustainability professionals, and community partners working to advance sustainable business practices here in Utah. We have an absolutely phenomenal leadership team, Alyssa Sheehan, Jeff Sokol, Tracy Harden, who's a local park guy. I think, Chris, you know her. Mm-hmm. She's wonderful. Lindsay Clark and Devin Patton. And our mission is to connect Utahns working at the intersection of business and sustainability with the people and the resources that can help them to achieve their organization's sustainability goals. And we do that in a couple of ways. So we do that by sharing links to things like local providers and success stories and incentive programs on our website, and also building community through events. One of our two most popular events are the Fall Flagship Networking event, which is going to focus on climate risk and resilience this year. That'll be in September or October. And our annual Utah legislation update that we host in partnership with Utah Clean Energy in January. And, you know, we just try to have a lot of fun with our events, right? A few years ago, we held a Just One Thing contest where we invited people to share a quick video highlighting just one thing that their organization is doing to advance sustainability. And it was just a huge hit. It was so much fun. And, it did a really good job of raising awareness of the great work that's being done by Utah organizations that a lot of people hadn't heard about. So that was pretty great.
And I met you at one of those events.
Yeah.
And I have to say that it was so great to see that many people in a room working towards the same goal and then having each other get to know a little bit more about what each person is doing, because I think collectively we make a big difference. So if I know you're doing this, how can I help you, and vice versa? And I feel like that's really happening in that community.
Yeah, I mean, that's 100% where we see the biggest value that we can add to this community, right? Helping you discover other people who are working towards the same thing here in Utah so that you can collaborate. So the event that you're talking about is the event that we had here at Alpine Distilling Social Club. Right. And we did that one in partnership with the Park City and Summit County Green Business Program. They're a wonderful, wonderful program. I've heard you mention them on here quite a bit. But we did some really fun facilitated networking exercises. Claire, had you shown up in time for the 70-person game of rock, paper, scissors?
I know. I'm sorry I missed that. I was here at the radio station.
Yes, it was a lot of fun. I got people mixing and talking. We also invited people to a constructive venting session. So it was just really great to get people mixing and talking about what they were doing. So, you know, the common thread in all of our events is that we love to partner with great Utah organizations. We love to put on events that help people connect and learn while also having a good time. So if I can, I'd really love to invite anyone who's listening or interested in advancing sustainability from a business perspective to join us. Membership is free and people can sign up via our website, utahsustainablebusiness.com. And if you're a sustainability solutions provider like Taurus or someone, or CE Solar, you know, please reach out to us so we can add your offerings to our website and help more Utah businesses find you.
Right. And how can people find you, Trish?
Oh, there's so many ways. So my website is sustainablecareerpathways.com. People are always welcome to connect with me on LinkedIn. And I'm also usually answering the Utah Sustainable Business Network email as well.
Trish Kenlon, founder of Sustainable Career Pathways and president of the Utah Sustainable Business Coalition. Thank you so much for joining us this
Thank
morning.
Thank you. This was this so much fun.
Yeah, all keep right. us posted on all those events, and we can talk about those as well here, because we love to see people collectively, like I said, gathering around this. So thank you so much.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you.